Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is Justin Vaccari. Justin Vaccari is a poet, critic, translator, and fiction writer. His poetry has won the Third Coast Award, and his first full-length book of poems, The Professional Weepers, received the Transcontinental Award from Pavement Saw Press. He is also the author of two books of criticism, Male Bisexuality in Current Cinema, and Mad Muses and the Early Surrealists. Hi, Justin. How are you?
Hi, Jan. I'm good. Thanks for having me on the air.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you're here. And it's kind of amazing that you have three books published in 1 year here.
It's been an incredible year, and it took a while to get to this place where I could say that. But yes, it's really been an incredible year.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And you're going to start with some poems from The Professional Weepers.
Yes, I'll be reading. This is my first book of poems, and it was published by Pavement Saw. And the poems I'll be reading today are all from The Professional Weepers.
Okay.
So I'll start with one that's called Tethered to Light. My body, my century. Both of you wrong, both of you with your impossible demands. Thick around the middle, collarbone and mane of roaring early days outstretched behind us. In the middle, clogging spy work and paper trails of bureaucratic rot. Our legs wriggling out into space-age futures, white light muffling our mushroom toes. The bomb desert testing in the guts. Now I wander, tethered to light, watching young lovers like pairs of dice who do not realize they themselves are only part of this landscape, changing as they too will change. As the century counted down, I began to count beads of cholesterol in my arteries, like telling a rosary, hoping to be reborn a different phylum. And this poem is called Nature. This originally appeared in The Pedestal. What is nature, then? Where does it begin and end? The room is full of nature tonight, natural books, natural music, the moon like a maitre d' peering through the window to see if a table is cleared and ready, your body on the bed, pulsing, almost headless, turned away. Another voice is lost in a hard swallow, the nature of things to evaporate. Because the lines that stretch between us bind us to ourselves. The world turns naturally and no one likes it. Is everything ready when I place my hand in the small of your back like one who slides a plate across a banquet table, eager to please and give the right impression? So now I'll read, this was the first poem of mine that won a major contest, and it was, when I got the phone call about it, I almost fell on the floor. I mean, it was just so unexpected and so wonderful. I still really like this poem a lot. It's, it references, a painter, a British painter named David Hockney. And the rest, I think, is self-explanatory. The MoMA, of course, is the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It's called Hockney Retrospective MoMA. Part one. We come to look at paintings when we don't want to look at people anymore. And so we learn to see people again. A famous art historian said to me at a faculty soiree, He was drunk, but hit on an essential truth. I thought of this, wandering the Hockney galleries, drawn to his swimming pools where naked men dove or swam or gazed serenely down at their opulent blue reflections. These were postcards from the life I'd heard about, Fire Island and Provincetown, postcards from the caravan that has moved on. In the stilled surfaces, a sense of forever I couldn't trust as much as I tried. I was visiting college friends in New York. They had a strange relationship. She begged kisses from him at the bar, complaining he never liked to kiss her. At parties, he snuck off to the bathroom and curled up in the tub. Once, when she couldn't protect him, some men beat him up. I guess I never really understood him until the party where he led me down a snowy driveway and unzipped me. He knelt, and I felt nothing but that familiar moment of forever, like a swimmer's dive, blank with its own pointed execution. Only later I remembered she begged her kisses from that mouth. Part two. A relief to have art to plunge into, to hide from my friends and the mess we'd made. And so we learn to see them again. In the MoMA, the men, like bright discarded shadows, towed the marble edge of their good life of sliding glass doors, tiles in sunshine, everything to order in an ordered world whose creator had already departed. Back in my friend's efficiency, above the bars and delis of Soho, she drank wine and leaned far out the window, had to be dragged back inside. I lay on the futon, sleepless. While in their loft overhead, I heard him roll on top with a grunt, her shuttered nose smothered away. Three more grunts and they were still again. The streets began to filter in, the sirens that never come to rest. I wanted to say I'm sorry. Okay, so this next one is a prose poem, and it's a bit more experimental. It's meant to evoke the feelings of another kind of love triangle, one in which I had the unrequited part. And it's named after a Pittsburgh neighborhood. It's called Shadyside. In another summer, you collected maps stolen from the feeders in the park. You sat in cafes, blue and brown subway trains spread across the table. Rivers baited the land in 100 different directions for $20 under a transparency used to trace outlines. Fed up, you took big, filthy bites of whatever you were given to eat. Everything we had been given on the risk of love and trust floating over time zones and borders. She belonged to that other city where we placed our bets, kept fueled and running like a getaway car, and where there would always be someone traveling the long course through your body.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Justin Vaccari, and he's reading from his new book, The Professional Weepress. Just came out from Pavement Saw Press and won the Transcontinental Award, so it's just a happy thing, because you've been writing for a long time, and I'm really happy to see this work out. Well, and I'm sure you are too.
Thank you very much, Jen. Yes, I mean, I had always dreamed of being a writer. It was my first dream, my original dream. It was also probably the only thing I've ever really been good at. It took me a while. I took a very high road that I don't recommend to anyone and just experimenting with my life and not really not pursuing the kind of path that I could have for a long time. But happily, I found that when I returned to writing, I still loved to do it, and I still could do it, and I had learned something mm-hmm. from the time in the wilderness, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So although I feel very lucky to have gotten here through a slightly unconventional route, I'm not entirely unhappy that it turned out, you know, that it all went the way it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Yeah. We were talking just briefly before the show about who could handle having a book in their 20s anyway. I mean, it's you know, you have to go out there and learn some stuff.
It kind of amazes me. I think that there is something to be said for the energy of youth, the indomitable spirit and that courage of youth. I think that it's very important to try to hold on to that as much as possible, even as one develops some other qualities of wisdom, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, going to your book, I love how you have such big ideas and big movements in your book. For example, your one poem is entitled Nature, is that?
The one I just read,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of bold to call a poem Nature.
And especially when everything in it is unnatural.
Yeah, and then I'm thinking, what is going to happen? And then in the poem it says, what is nature then? And then you go to natural books, and then natural wind, I think, and then the moon like a major D, and the body on the bed. And you go from this huge thing, but in four lines, we're on the bed. And I thought that was kind of amazing and great.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it just to accept the fact that the world turns every day has become almost a radical act of preservation, I think, because we live in times where it seems like there are a lot of demagogues who don't even accept that fundamental premise that the world just turns of its own accord every day, and they're trying to make it turn a different way or not turn. And so I feel like, you know, even in the private spaces of life, nature, although in some ways corrupted by the unnatural, the mass-produced, et cetera, needs to be reclaimed as, if anything, a sort of surrender to natural processes.
Mm-hmm. I like how we always come back to some kind of body or some kind of love in your book. And, I mean, the professional weepers, we think, you know, there's going to be a lot at stake, and there always is, and I really appreciate that about your work.
Thank you.
But I have to agree with you on the David Hockney poem. I thought that was a really strong poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's a lot to talk about, but why don't you read a few more poems and we'll talk some more.
Okay, thank you. I think that I will read two ekphrastic poems. This first one was inspired by one of my favorite painters, Vasily Kandinsky, and it's meant to evoke some of the events around the Russian Revolution of 1917. And it's called Kandinsky. It's the tabernacle where the people gather, tilted from gravity and the curve of the earth. It lists toward the sun, eclipsing one side of the road and the one-armed woman. It's a sea urchin used as a palate under the sun's gold pate. The new city upheavals its head through the shifting plates of the old, covered in chalk-lime afterbirth, gray and red cobblestones, no midwife, no doctor needed. Birth comes when it comes, a shattered plow insignia, and all the old buildings like curtains of bricks pushed aside with the shadows of the unvisited graveyard where cannons fire on the tombs, mountains of corpses, dreadful suffering of all kinds, inner culture put on hold. Churches burn away like giant tapers and crows, vultures fly up into a crack of sun. Work, 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 shark teeth bite walls. The rays of the ocean bring night from below. All revolts are built on water, heaviness floating before it sinks. Other wedges penetrate the little house, the exploding fence posts, the tree, a fixture planted mid-wave, the aerial earring of gold through the roof where you wish to escape all rules by early departure. And then this next poem is actually about a West German performance artist named Ulrike Rosenbach, who first came to prominence in the 1970s. And this poem is referencing a video installation piece that she did, in which she bound the body of her daughter to her own with long long white bandages, kind of like a papoose. And so this poem imagines the voice of the daughter having grown up and thinking back on this moment of bonding with her mother. I think the only thing I might need to say is that Mutti is the German word for mommy. And it's called Ulrike's Daughter. I remember when Mutti bound me to her, the two rounds of warmth of her breasts against my shoulders, the feel of her arm wrapped around me. Her breath on my neck was heavy with movement and the watchful camera, while I held mine in, afraid the taut swathes would hurt my ribs if I didn't make extra room. In the end, I floated against her, held in place, and could not fall out of my gauzy prison, a ritual that ought to be practiced in our tribe. No thought stays longer than the thought of touch. No memory is harder to summon up or to forget. With the ease and comfort of stocking feet or a palm full of water, we run on a loop in a Berlin museum. Our double gaze defies the passers-by who yearn to be the flesh of someone's flesh. Is it true they sold their children's names long ago? Is it true the only phone lines exist in our memories?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest this day is Justin Vaccari, and he's a poet. And I keep thinking that Prosody is still on at in the evening, but no, here we are at 6:30 a.m. okay, Justin, I wanted to ask you about the movement in your poems. And how you move between some really large statements and then some beautifully rendered details. You know, for example, in the Kandinsky poems, you have big statements like all revolts are built on water, and then you give us all these details of the exploded fence posts and the chalk line afterbirth, I think.
The chalk lime afterbirth.
Yeah. It's just kind of amazing to me how you keep, it feels like this revolving movement between details and then big statements and then back to details. I don't know if you look at it that way.
I do and I don't. I'm aware of doing some of that, but I try when if I'm allowing myself to sort of lapse into a more abstract a thought for a few lines, I always try, in fact, intentionally to surround it with visceral or beautiful imagery. Because I don't believe necessarily that the heart and the mind are disconnected, or the soul and the body, if you will. I don't really subscribe to those dualities. I believe that there is a kind of mingling of these supposed opposites, which goes on constantly. And, you know, I mean, I'm far from being the first, the stream of consciousness writers of the modernist era were great pioneers of this. In a way, psychoanalysis has also taught us a great deal about these spillings over of the primal or the inchoate into everyday life. My feeling is that poetry should be beautiful. I've always believed that it's important for poetry to be beautiful, and that one can still say something meaningful and substantial within that beauty.
You're talking about beauty in terms of sound.
In terms of music, yes, the music of the poem, the sound.
Not necessarily the message, if there
is
a message.
No, because it was always my ambition to try to write a lyric poetry that was both beautiful, but that also had occasionally disturbing or even brutal images, in the sense that I'm as much a child of punk rock and Nirvana and industrial art as much as I am of some of my favorite poets, including Hart Crane, who I'll be reading about a little bit later. Somewhere in that mixture of Hart Crane rhetoric and maybe the guitar sound of Nirvana is kind of what I like to aim for.
Somewhere in there. Okay. Well, you've given yourself a wide berth, so that's good.
And a messy one.
Good. Okay. We only have about 5 minutes left, so maybe you could get to Hart Crane sooner than later.
Okay. Let's. That seems like a good segue. So this poem really is written out of my identification with Hart Crane, and I've said before that he's my favorite poet, and also the example of his life was something that always led me to want to speak out, to want to try to overcome a lot of the stigma and shame that still surrounds having an unconventional queer sexuality. So this is called With Hart Crane and the Fireflies in the Park, and it begins with two lines from the bridge. Each seemed a child, like me on a loose perch, holding to childhood like some termless play. I come to question your shade among the park's empty benches. Fireflies wobble and flurry these violet grasses in fleshy August, like passions that can't be sustained, fade in one place to gleam again somewhere else. Those Thomas Alvas whose patented light my friends and I, as child entrepreneurs, exploited in scrubbed-out jelly jars with pinholed lids. The waxing moon and stars are light enough to show the dregs of day, stubbed butts, wrappers, and fast food bags twisted to unfillable funnels. A raped condom wrinkles out like the shed skin of a balloon, and a couple's drugged laughter echoes from that hillock in rushes risen to a hushing fall. I'm moved by your boyhood climb behind your daddy's refinery to oversee the hobo's squat on the margins of the family holdings. Your kinship to their helpless, prolonged childhood ended at the line drawn for you, the majority share, kept you wary in this world where men must press each mean advantage. Did you come to see verse as just another way to force one's name above the crowd? Language, however worked, is never ours. You made yourself smaller than a boy, shrank to flotsam off Ozymandias. 75 years of marches, of pamphlets and campaigns leave me sitting on this waiting bench of ours, heart, ear cocked to murmurs and hooings, midnight's prey, and you are still my chest's painful pounding, you who went underground to hum torch songs you'd sometimes heard showgirls bray on Broadway boards above, went down to keep the sunny, proper places of your life buttoned up clean against shadow. Shadow sticks to what it touches, or a hand that touches it, though only once. We are always half between the itch to wander off, the urge to hurry home. We burn like the sad dilemma of all fireflies beaten to a jar.
Nice poem. Really nice poem.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, but we're out of time. It's the poetry of Justin Vaccari, and he's reading from his new book, The Professional Weepers. Thank you so much for being here, Justin.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's been wonderful.
It's been great. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.